Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I appreciate you joining me for a little bit as we continue to go through the big old monster box of baseball cards. And we've gone through year by year. We're moving into different decades now. And here we are. It's 1993, one of my favorite years for collecting cards. In fact, it was really my last year of fully diving into baseball cards and collecting. So I've got quite a few cards from that year. And there were quite a few cards that were out there. And we're going to have some interesting sets of cards to look at and some interesting players. And we certainly found one of the most interesting, to put it nicely, players from 1993, Bowman set, card number 94, Carl Everett of the Florida Marlins. Yes, he was an original member of the Florida Marlins, not on opening day 1993, but he would eventually make it into the lineup in the 93 season. Kid from my own backyard here in Tampa, Florida. Very talented, extremely gifted player, but very similar to Albert Bell. Got himself in a lot of trouble. Now, Albert Bell was able to straighten his life out and kind of mellow out. Carl Everett didn't, unfortunately. In fact, his life has gone the other way. But you could clearly see signs of his, how shall we put it, eccentricities back in the 1990s. And when we go through his career, you'll see that pretty much every major league team he played for, and he played for quite a few throughout his career, pretty much every team he played for, he had a shelf life of about 2 years. After 2 years, it was time to move on, and he was often traded throughout his career. But he was a World Series winner and a pretty darn good outfielder and designated hitter, so we'll talk a little bit about his career and the 93 Bowman set in just a little bit. First, we've got a lot to talk about in regards to our Twitter feed, Wax and Gum Stains. We've had a whole lot of things happening this weekend. And one of them is, of course, reaction to our most previous podcast on 92 Tops. So we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I'm going to start off with something that happened this past weekend. I finally got around to buying a handful of packs of 2017 Topps Series 1. And I mentioned this in my last podcast, or maybe the podcast before that. I said that when I saw the demo shot that Topps tweeted out of, I think it was a Clayton Kershaw card, and this was back maybe about 4 or 5 months ago. When I saw it, and just seeing it on Twitter, I liked it. And, you know, I'll always go out and buy, you know, a few packs of the base set anyway, even though my vice in card collecting these days is really Topps Heritage. And I'm very much looking forward to that set, which will be coming out in a few weeks. But I always like, you know, picking up a few packs every year, just opening them up, seeing what you can find in them. And you get some very interesting cards these days. And I really like the overall design of the 2017 Topps set. Series 1, it's got a very unique design, as you well know, with not only just action shots, and you've got the, you know, the graphic angles of cards, but also like the photographs are at an angle too. So it's a rather unique way of presenting the pictures. And of course, you know, cards in 2017, there's different card stock. There's a lot of different information on the back of the cards. There's different ways of presenting the photos. So is it quite the same as when I was a kid opening up these cards in the late 80s and early 90s? No, but there's still a pretty fun, unique feel of ripping open a pack and just seeing what's in there. Even if I don't know all the players necessarily, or even if I don't know all of the variations, and there are plenty of variations and inserts, I will say, even if you're not as big of a collector now as you were as a kid, or even if you are a big collector now, but you're somebody who specializes in certain inserts and, you know, certain, you know, parallel cards and stuff like that, buy a few packs of the base set and just rip open the packs and have some fun with it. It's definitely something that not only, you know, harkens back to younger days, but it's just, as I've said before, it's just so stress relieving these days. And there's a lot of stress out there. There's a whole lot of crap going on in this world today, and we're inundated with it every day. And that's actually the downside of social media, is that, you know, what used to be kind of behind closed doors and we didn't really know about, I mean, now it's front and center every day. some people, they choose to buy coloring books. Some people prefer vices that are a little more destructive, such as drugs or drinking. But there's nothing wrong with just opening up a pack of baseball cards. And for even if it's just 30 seconds that you're thumbing through the cards and just seeing what you have in there. It's just a nice little throwback to a simpler time when you were a kid. You had nothing really to worry about, and that was your escape. So it's nice to escape with that nowadays. Now, some interesting things from this 2017 pack that I opened up. A couple of interesting cards that I pulled. One is a Mother's Day card. It was Evan Gattis of the Houston Astros. So I've got this parallel card, and that's kind of neat. And then I pulled the Rediscover Tops card. And this is something that you're going to see frequently throughout packs. I believe the buyback rate is 1 in 6 packs. So if you buy a handful of packs, there's a good chance you're going to get at least one, if not two, of these. And basically what it is, it's these older Tops cards that have stamped in it on the side. It says Rediscover Tops. And of course, there's variations to that. It's not just having an old card with this branding on it, which automatically gives it a different value. But there's bronze lettering, there's silver lettering, there's gold lettering, there's red lettering, which is apparently the rarest of them all. So I'm thumbing through this one pack of cards that I opened up. And right there, I pull out one of these Rediscover Tops cards. And I kind of went, ugh, because, listen, I love old cards. Obviously, I'm doing a podcast about them, so it's always fun to pull an old card. And I took a picture of this. I put it up on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. It's an 88 Tops. So right there, womp, womp, yeah, you know, it's just, oh, 88 Tops. And then it's pinch-hitting extraordinaire Jim Dwyer. And no offense to Jim Dwyer, he had a very long career. He was in the bigs for, I want to say, 17 or 18 years. And when I say pinch hitter extraordinaire, I mean it. I mean, this is a guy who specialized in getting called in off the bench in the sixth inning, and he'd put in a couple of at-bats and work the field for a couple of innings. But, you know, 88 Tops and seeing Jim Dwyer, and of course, he was with the Baltimore Orioles then. And the 88 Orioles, if you forgot, started that season 0-23. So it's just like, you know, a triple whammy there. It's just like, okay, not a star card. It's 88 Tops, and he was with the really bad Orioles. But since it is the silver type where it says Rediscover Tops, I guess there's a little more value to it. But I did find it kind of neat. So that's an added bonus if you're one to buy the new 2017 Topps Series 1. And you like old cards, you're going to see some of these in there. And the fact that it's 1 in every 6 packs, those are the odds. I think that's kind of neat. You know that if you buy, like I said, a handful of packs, there's a good chance you're going to get one, if not two. And of course, there are some more valuable cards out there, some more valuable or more notable players than Jim Dwyer that are floating around in the Topps packs these days. But I'll be honest, that's going to be one of those things that I probably end up forcing myself to buy a few extra packs. You know, I've been trying to actually, even though I've gotten back into the hobby over the last few years, I've tried to limit my consumption to, okay, I'm going to buy a lot of heritage packs because that's the set that I like. And I'll buy some base set packs and, you know, probably at the end of the season, I'll buy the complete set just to say that I have it. And then that way, you know, you're not spending hundreds of dollars on all these cards and then they're just sitting in a box, you know, just really doing nothing. But once again, Topps is just going to sucker me right in because there's a chance that I can pull that 88 Jim Dwyer. Boy, they're brilliant over there at Topps. They know how to keep pulling you right back in. And, you know, after I tweeted that photo, I got a lot of commentary on a lot of people like it. And, you know, got a really funny comment from Rick Taylor. He says, ironically, the card you hold is much rarer than the original card by multiple factors. And you're right, Rick. And I don't have a price guide, or Beckett.com opened up right in front of me. But yeah, the rare silver type Rediscover Tops 88 Jim Dwyer card will probably actually fetch me $8 or $10 on eBay. Now, as for some other commentary in our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, talking about the 92 Tops set, Tim Murray, when these came out, I was sad to see end of wax packs and gum. Still am. And I am too, Tim, and that's why I called 91 Tops the last fun baseball card set. And even though I liked 92 Tops back then, still like it now, still tell collectors, hey, if you got a few extra bucks, go ahead and buy some. It's a neat set to collect. Yeah, you don't have that unique wax and gum and cardboard smell anymore because, well, they got rid of the gum. They actually got rid of the wax back in 1991. And, of course, the cardboard stock, the much thicker, better quality card stock moving forward. Kevin Hickerson says, 92 was great. Thought the stadium back was cool. Gold cards, first parallel set, scratch-off game, lots of fun. And that's the key to the 92 set. It really was a fun set. And even though the value of it these days is not nearly as high as it was 25 years ago, but it was fun then, and it still is now, although you can't redeem the cards from the scratch-off contest. It was fun to open up a pack, see what cards you got. There was the scratch-off game, and I must have gone through, I don't know, how many spare pennies and nickels just scratching off those cards. But, you know, that's how you got the winner gold cards. So there was the subset to the subset. Well, 93 Tops, you had the gold card, and then you had the black gold card, and you had the black gold card that you would redeem. And that was just a subset to a subset to a subset. So that could cause some confusion very easily. It could cause confusion where you had the base set and then the gold set and then the black gold set. And then, of course, by the mid-90s, all producers of baseball cards were creating all of these various subsets to subsets. And that caused even some more confusion, but also desertion. You know, collectors such as myself, you just kind of got away from that because it was just too confusing as to what was going on. And that actually leads me into a comment about the 93 sets. This podcast is not the definitive history of baseball cards, although I'm sure some people will see it that way. I want to put that out there because, you know, this is just coming from my own personal collection. That's how the podcast started. It was opening up this box and kind of, you know, thumbing through the cards and finding some very interesting cards along the way and wanting to share these cards and the player stories with you. Well, when I was thumbing through the 93 cards, and I don't have a whole lot from 93. Like I said, this was my final year of really collecting and then getting away from it for a good 10 or 12 years. The 93 sets, I'm going through them like, okay, all right, I've got Bowman, I've got Tops, I've got this, I got that, da-da-da-da-da-da. And I realized there were some that were missing. And, you know, some of them are missing because it was part of the Great Purge. As I've told the story before, getting rid of a lot of these cards over the years just because I didn't want to lug them around anymore. But some of them, too, I just didn't buy in 1993 because there were so many card sets out there. Even I, as a savvy 16-year-old at the time, had to, you know, pick and choose. There was no more of just grabbing a Donruss, a Fleer, and a Topps and having at it. There were so many card sets that there were some that I missed. So as we go through the 93 sets, you will notice missing Topps Stadium Club. For some reason, I didn't buy any Topps Stadium Club cards in 1993, or at least I didn't keep them. I'm not really sure. I can also tell you that there is no Donruss Triple Play, and there is no Fleer. And I kind of surprised myself as I'm going through this. I'm like, wait a minute. I don't have any 93 Fleer cards. And I thought, well, why is that? And then I looked back and, you know, saw pictures of the cards, and I very quickly figured out why. I never bought any Fleer cards in 1993. The Fleer set was very dull. It was not up to the standard that everybody else had raised their cards to. So as I went back and tried to see what sets I had to talk about, I kept Topps, I kept Upper Deck, I kept Bowman. You'll also see studio cards will be in there. Fleer Ultra, I bought quite a few of those in 1993. Donruss as well. But Fleer just did not catch up with everybody else. I actually bought a few packs of Score. And that's ironic because Score was a very, very average set compared to the competition in 1993. But yeah, I didn't go out of my way to buy Fleer in 1993. So with that said, as we wrap up this review of the Monster Box cards, again, from my own personal collection here, you will notice that we're going to skip over Stadium Club, we're going to skip over Donruss Triple Play, and we're going to skip over Fleer. And that's just simply because I don't have any of those cards now, or I didn't buy them back then. And I know Fleer for a fact. When I looked back at the pictures of the set, I went, oh yeah, I didn't buy those back then. And I know why. They were not very good. So that's a pretty good sign of the erosion of the hobby, even though I was a fanatic card collector back then. You know, 1993, like I said, I was 16 years old. I was really into the sport, really into the hobby, really loved, you know, the baseball season in 93 was a great season. And, you know, I go looking back at these cards and I see why I started pulling away, because even though as a 16-year-old, I was making more money, you know, doing odd jobs here and there, and I was adding to what was already a massive collection. You know, I had 40 or 50,000 sports cards back then. It was just too much, even for me. And, you know, I was in the wheelhouse. I was the collector that I'm pretty sure all of the companies wanted. But there was just too much out there. And then, of course, just to conclude the story, you know, the following year you have the strike. You know, also I'm moving into my senior year in high school, so I'm doing less and less, let's be honest, nerdy stuff like buying baseball cards and, you know, trying to be that rough and tough teenager, you know, trying to pick up girls and trying to get a car and picking out a college to go to. So that kind of severed, you know, the hobby for me. So notably missing some big name sets in 1993. So we're not going to touch on them on the podcast, but please know that Stadium Club and Fleer and Triple Play did make sets in 1993. I just decided not to keep any of those cards. Now, if you have any comments about anything we discussed, be it the podcast that we do, the players that we talk about, or maybe a new set of cards, you know, the 2017 Topps Series 1 came out just a few days ago. You've got thoughts on that. Anything about the hobby, you're more than welcome to discuss it on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Make sure you share that Twitter feed with your friends, your collector friends, those who collected then, those who still collect now. And make sure you get the word out about Wax Ecstatic as we come your way on Tuesdays and Fridays via Audioboom and iTunes. And by the way, coming soon, via Wax and Gum Stains, I'm going to be putting out a survey. I want to hear from you, first of all, what you like about this podcast, what you don't like about this podcast, but also what direction we go in after we get through 1993. Now, I've said before, I'm going to do a couple podcasts, two or three podcasts on minor league cards, no logo cards, team produced sets. We'll do that. I've had a couple people say, hey, you should do the hockey cards too. Again, as tempted as I am, I'd rather not right now. Maybe that comes around later. But we want to see where this goes. You know, do we basically go back to 1981 and do some, you know, random pulls again? You know, probably do a little less talk about the set itself and talk more about the player that we pull. Or, and this is an interesting thought that I've had, again, just going through the personal set, do we rewind as far back as my cards go? And I do have one card from 1954. My set then, or my collection then, picks up from 1957 and goes right on up through 1980. It's not a monster box. However, there is a binder full of cards, and we could do a random pull there and talk about those sets. So be on the lookout for that. That'll be coming out over the next couple of weeks, and we will link it up to our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Now, as for our card today, 93 Bowman, which had a very difficult task of trying to follow the legendary 92 Bowman set, which is still, all these years later, a winner. And 93 Bowman, for the most part, did that. While some cards got carried away in trying to be too premium, and some cards got carried away trying to be too contemporary, you know, looking too much like 1993. And Bowman is a little guilty of that, and I'll show you why in just a little bit. I think the 93 Bowman set is an absolute classic. Of course, by then, Bowman was the card for the prospect, the card for the rookie card collector. And what better rookie card to have in 1993 than Derek Jeter? And the Jeter card is still the anchor of that set. You can get some cards, ungraded. And I've seen, depending on where you get it, anywhere from $10 to $30. And of course, if you grade them, the value goes way up from there. But you also had the second year, Mariano Rivera. You've got some other young stars. Andy Pettit has a rookie card in this set. Young stars, like I said, Manny Ramirez and Ivan Rodriguez and Ken Griffey Jr., of course. All the stars that are getting into the Hall of Fame and we remember so well from that era, a lot of them were up and coming in the early 1990s. And one of those up-and-coming players was Carl Everett, who was a first-round draft pick of the Yankees. And we'll talk a little more about Carl Everett's career and rather sordid life afterwards. But first, let's take a look at the card. This is card number 94 from the 93 Bowman set. And you see Bowman keeping a lot of the same traits from the winner of a 92 set, in that you have a white border, although it's a little smaller than the 92 Bowman border. You have the white border, but then pretty much everything else is dedicated just to the photograph. You have a rather large Bowman logo in the upper left-hand corner. In the lower right-hand corner, you have the player's name. His last name is superimposed over a little bit of a color bar, while the first name is just kind of hanging out there over the picture. And then you've got the picture, and what a picture of Carl Everett looking kind of surly in his brand new Florida Marlins jersey. Everett didn't play with the Marlins until the middle of the 93 season, but here he is. I'm assuming this is a spring training or some kind of a rookie camp photograph from the early spring or late winter of 1993. And it's a very ugly jersey. I never liked the Florida Marlins. I never liked them. I've started to warm up to them now only because my son loves every baseball team he sees on TV. And here in Tampa, we're actually very lucky. We not only get the Tampa Bay Rays games, but the Miami Marlins games. The Marlins I've actually warmed up to over the last couple of seasons. I've been to their ballpark. Absolutely beautiful. They've got a very fun team to watch. It'll be interesting to see how Don Mattingly steers that team in the 2017 season. But 1993, I hated the Marlins, absolutely hated them, and mostly because a lot of people here in the Tampa Bay area thought that that expansion team should have been ours. We had the stadium waiting. We had, all these other teams had courted Tampa Bay to basically use us as a tool to get a brand new stadium elsewhere. Most notably, of course, the San Francisco Giants were supposed to move here in 1992. That didn't happen. Seattle Mariners, Chicago White Sox, Baltimore Orioles, and in some form or fashion, Texas Rangers, Toronto Blue Jays, Oakland A's, you name it. There was a team that wanted to get a new stadium, and they used the Tampa Bay market as leverage for that political battle. Well, when the National League announced that they were going to expand for the 1993 season, and they were going to make the announcement in 1991, it seemed that it was going to be a shoo-in. Well, Tampa, St. Pete, they've got to have a team. They're ready. Well, lo and behold, it was Miami. And for a couple of reasons why Miami got it over Tampa Bay, one is Miami is a larger market than Tampa. Now, the Tampa St. Pete area has grown tremendously over the last 25 years. And when you look in terms of media, it's number 11 in TV, number 19 in radio. So you're a top 20 market there. Well, Miami was always top 10 and growing. So you had that. But also you had the very deep pockets of one H. Wayne Huizenga, who, of course, started the waste management or made the waste management company into a major trash hauling and recycling company. And then from those funds, he was able to finance what became Blockbuster Video, which in 1993 was truly a blockbuster company. I mean, they were making money hand over fist back then. So back in 1993, or rather 1991, when they made the announcement that it was going to be Miami and Denver, The steam was coming out of everybody's ears here because we thought we were going to get a team. And, of course, we eventually got the Rays, but there was a lot of thought that the Marlins should have been our team. So we always cast a rather jagged dagger in our eyes toward the Marlins. And because I didn't like the Marlins from the beginning, I never liked their jerseys, the teal, and I even hated saying the word teal because it just sounded too foo-foo. The blue-green, whatever color you want to call it, I just never liked it. And now you kind of look back at it and you go, you know, those old Marlins jerseys, they were pretty ugly. Yeah, very 1993. Let's flip the card over, shall we? And this is very 1993 as well. This is where Bowman gets a little guilty in trying to be too contemporary as opposed to being really classy or classic, if you will. And I thought the 92 Bowman set did that. But in 1993, you've got the player's name in a rather 1993 script in the upper left-hand corner, overlaying a kind of a wood grain look here, kind of a baseball bat look that runs across the top of the card where the card name and the card number is in the upper right hand corner, along with his personal information. Running along vertically on the left side is the team name. So again, going totally 1993 with a look here. You've got a picture of the player, and here is Carl Everett just looking thrilled to be a member of the Florida Marlins in 1993. And then on the right half of the card, you've got stats and some scouting report. Now, for veteran players, you have more stats. But for a guy like Carl Everett, who had not even made it in the major leagues, in fact, you look at his stats here, it says minor league batting record, you only had just a couple of lines, one for the 1992 season and one for his career. And then you've got a pretty detailed scouting report here, and I'll read. The availability of Everett was one of Florida's most pleasant surprises in the expansion draft. Well, as we will discuss, perhaps the New York Yankees were onto something when they left him exposed. Hamstring woes erased more than half of his 92 season, but the Marlins were already familiar with his leadoff hitter-type skills. Carl's defense should one day make him a regular on the Plays of the Week highlight tapes. Now, that's a pretty dated statement right there. First of all, Plays of the Week. Of course, with the internet now, I mean, you see a highlight, it's posted 5 minutes after it happens. But highlight tapes, yes, we were still living in the days of VHS entertainment. So that's the back of the 93 Bowman card. Again, kind of guilty of looking like 1993. But certainly Bowman was not the only set that did that back then. Overall, though, still a very quality set. And of course, with the 93 Bowman set, you see a lot of things that you saw in 92. Very high quality cardstock, the UV coating, which did cause some cards to stick to one another, depending on how you stored them. But also, like I mentioned before, a very good group of rookie cards led by Derek Jeter and star cards. Now, this was a big set. This was over 700 cards. I think the exact number was 706 or maybe 708. It was a very big set for 1993. And because you had all of the cards that were within the set, and then you had the numerous copies of the set, much like every other set in 1993, the value of these cards not nearly as high now as they were back then. However, there is still some value. Collectors still absolutely love this set, not only because of the Derek Jeter card, but you also have the parallel foil cards. So that's still something 24 years later. It's still fun to open up packs and look for those. And if you happen to land one of a star player, or I know I have somewhere in a folder a Chipper Jones foil card. Is it $800? No, but it might be $8 if you're lucky. You know, that's a fun thing to chase after all these years later. Now, I was looking around. I've seen no factory sets, but I've seen hand-collated sets going for about $30. And wax boxes, or wax, well, they were cellophane boxes, but you know what I mean. The packs. You could still get pack boxes for anywhere between $50 and $70, although they kind of, they're a little closer to the $50 to $60 range. And by the way, when I quote prices, this is just doing a quick internet search. This is, again, not a definitive price guide, anything I say in this podcast. Obviously, if you go to a card show, if you go to a community yard sale, you go to somebody's garage sale, and they're just trying to unload this stuff, you can definitely get it for much cheaper than somebody who's running a brick and mortar business online and trying to move out product that way. But still, the point is that 93 Bowman, in a year where there was just an incredibly gluttonous amount of cards out there, 93 Bowman still has some value, as opposed to if you're digging around 93 Score or 93 Fleer or 93 Donruss. There's still some value in the packs. There's still some fun chasing some of these cards in the packs. And, of course, because you've got a somewhat more limited run than what you saw in the other 93 sets, there's still a little more cash value to it. If you have a little extra money and you want to buy that set, absolutely do it. Even though there is a little bit of a 1993 look to it, it is still a great set and chock full of rookies and all those star cards that, again, you know, the stars that matured throughout the 90s and some of them are in the Hall of Fame. Some of them are very memorable players, even if they aren't Hall of Fame worthy. Will cost you a little more as opposed to some of the other sets if you're trying to put it together, but still a pretty good set to have and to collect and to chase a little bit. Now, speaking of interesting players, we bring you the random pull from our collection here. Carl Everett, as I mentioned, from Tampa, and an absolute stud athlete. He actually excelled in football. He went to Hillsborough High School. He was a stud football player. In fact, ran for almost 1,000 yards as a senior. And I would not be surprised one bit if he was another, you know, Bo Jackson, Deion Sanders in the making, where they thought maybe this guy could play, two different sports at the same time. But he gradually went over to baseball. So he became another quality player coming out of Tampa. And again, this was a glory day era. There were so many great baseball players coming out of Tampa. And Carl Everett was going to be the next big star to come out of Tampa, much like in this era, Tino Martinez and Luis Gonzalez. And of course, you have, Gary Sheffield and Dwight Gooden before them. Well, it didn't quite work out. And a lot of the reason because of that is not only because of injuries, as that did hamper him early on in his career, but also his attitude. He had a very, very crappy attitude, to put it nicely. And major league teams very quickly found out that the shelf life of Carl Everett on your team was roughly 2 years. And you'll see when you look through his transactions, after about 2 years, teams just gave up. They moved on from him and they would trade him somewhere else. And that was the case in 1992 at the expansion draft. You know, the Yankees selected Carl Everett in the first round. He was the 10th pick overall in 1990, but just had it with him by 1992. So they expose him in the expansion draft. The Marlins, of course, pick him up. And he makes his debut on July 1st, 1993. And he had a very short cup of coffee in the 93 season, appeared in only 11 games. Same thing in 1994, only 16 games. And there was nothing here that said this guy is going to be a star. It just, nothing really stood out other than potential. And sometimes in sports, potential is a bad thing because it means you still haven't quite lived up to the expectations. So after the 1994 strike-shortened season, the Marlins move him to the Mets for Kilvio Varas, and you start seeing Carl Everett producing here. Of course, the Mets were not a very good team, so he got plenty of playing time, 79 games in 95, 101 games in 96, and 142 games in 97. Now in 95 and 97, you saw the potential come out as he was hitting around 250, 260. He started popping a few home runs, driving in a few runs back then. But again, with the Mets being a pretty bad team, pretty much flying under the radar. And of course, his shenanigans were starting to wear thin even on a growing Mets team. So in the winter of 1997, they move him to Houston for John Hudek. Now, Carl Everett starts really knocking the ball out of the park here as he has 15 home runs in 98, 25 home runs in 99, brings his average up. He's now starting to hit over 300, and he's starting to get attention, and not necessarily for things off the field, but he's actually contributing on the field. So you could say, all right, Carl Everett is a late bloomer, and the Astros starting to, rebuild after the 1999 season, they send him to Boston for Greg Miller and Adam Everett. Now, Everett would have a fairly decent career with the Astros, and Miller never got out of the minor leagues. But this is where the interesting side of Carl Everett came out. First of all, he was an all-star. He hit 300 in 2000, 34 home runs, 108 RBI. But he most notably got into some arguments with the Boston fans, also the Boston media. He really had a tit-for-tat with Boston Globe columnist Dan Shaughnessy. And the awkward side of Carl Everett came out, as during this time, he let it be known that he was not a fan of dinosaurs. Check that. He believed that dinosaurs never existed. And I actually found the quote here. This is crazy. God created the sun, the stars, the heavens, and the earth, and then made Adam and Eve. The Bible never says anything about dinosaurs. You can't say there were dinosaurs when you never saw them. Somebody actually saw Adam and Eve eating apples. No one ever saw a Tyrannosaurus Rex. End quote. And he also said that, you know, dinosaur bones that are being found, you know, fossil collections, there's no truth to that. And all of a sudden you're like, okay, this guy's a good hitter, but he's also on another planet. And by 2001, the Red Sox had had enough of his shenanigans there, and they trade him to Texas for Darren Oliver. Now, he continues to star in Texas as he hits 267 in the 2002 season, 16 home runs, 58 RBI, but he wears out his welcome midway through the season. In fact, July 1st, 2003, he's traded to the Chicago White Sox for a collection of players that were collected over the player to be named later category, Frank Francisco, Josh Roop, and Anthony Webster. Now, he becomes a prolific star in Chicago, as he was an all-star in 2003. Of course, a lot of that coming from his experience in Texas, but he still played in the game. And he hit 301 with 10 home runs and 41 RBIs. Now, even though he was contributing to an up-and-coming White Sox team, they really didn't want anything with him after the 2003 season, so they grant free agency to him. He goes to the Montreal Expos, and even though the Expos already had one foot out the door and they're heading over to Washington, D.C. for the next season, they have enough of him midway through the 2003 season. So they trade him back to the White Sox for Gary Majewski and John Roush. And with the White Sox, they kind of put up with his nonsense, but he continues to contribute at the plate and contributes to the World Series championship that they would win in 2005. In 2004, he had, and this was split between the Expos and White Sox, he batted 260, had only 7 home runs and 82 games played. Again, injuries were really affecting his play back then. But in 2005, he puts in almost a full season, hits 251, 23 home runs, plays in 135 games, and more importantly, fills the roster spot as the designated hitter that was left vacant by Frank Thomas. Of course, as we mentioned in our 92 Upper Deck podcast, Thomas's career starting to go downhill at this point in time. So Everett steps in as the DH, and he helps the White Sox win their first World Series since 1917. Now, even though he is a World Series champion and this guy was able to provide to this championship team, the White Sox for the second time say, okay, bye-bye. And he signs as a free agent with the Seattle Mariners, gets into some tiffs with umpires and opposing team pitchers, lasts only 92 games, and he is released midway through the 2006 season. In his career, bats 271, 202 home runs, 792 RBI, and a 14-year career that was cut short tremendously by injuries. But again, the off-the-field antics, you know, he was suspended several times. He was fined several times. And again, the shelf life with pretty much any team they played for started at 2 years. But as you could see, near the end of his career, sometimes he was moved mid-season just to get him out of the clubhouse. All right, the guy was talented, but he was also a bit of a basket case. And in addition to the dinosaur stuff, he got a lot of flack for his views on homosexuality. He was very anti-gay. Said that, I remember in one interview, he said that if he found out that there was a teammate that was gay, that he would demand to be traded or leave the team. In other comments, he said that, he knew that there were gay players on his team, but even though he didn't demand a trade, he just thought that it was a wrong thing. And, this is kind of old thinking, and this is somebody's opinion. If they don't agree with homosexuality or how that, I don't know, happens or the impact in social life of a homosexual person or a couple. But obviously he's saying all of this stuff, and this is about 10 or 12 years ago. He's saying all of this as social views of homosexuality and gay rights are vastly, rapidly changing. And I think you're seeing a generation divide. Here's a guy who growing up in the 80s, this was a bad thing, whereas a generation that is growing up in the early 2000s, much more open and accepting to that lifestyle. For Carl Everett, he was against it, and you had two totally different generations just going head-to-head here. So he didn't believe in dinosaurs, didn't like gay people. He had a lot of controversies, very set in his ways off the field, and I think that's what really kind of tarnishes his career. Again, a very talented, gifted athlete, as I mentioned, a football star. I think he was also a track and field star in high school, clearly a good baseball player, but was just never able to take all that personal nonsense and push it off to the side and focus on having a good career. If he was able to do that, I think we would speak far more highly of Carl Everett, despite the eccentric personality or the controversial things that he said. I think people would look back at his career with a little more positive view than what you see now. And of course, Everett didn't help out his own cause. Several years ago, arrested and charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, reportedly held a handgun to the head of his wife. He was married for a long time too, and it's really sad to see this as kind of a footnote to his career here. So a guy who really could have been something but fell so short, not just on the field because of injuries and just a lack of production, but off the field as well, getting into some legal trouble, really just puts kind of a damper on his entire career. And I haven't heard of anything or seen anything on Carl Everett since that arrest. And when was that arrest? Let me see. I'll check my notes here. 2011. There was a lot of hubbub around that, obviously, because that wasn't too long after his career ended. But really, ever since then, haven't seen anything, on what he's doing or even where he is nowadays. So he's kind of gone MIA all these years later. But you can remember the promise, the prospect, the potential. There's the dirty word, the potential of Carl Everett in 1993, just beginning his major league career. And we can remember that as the Florida Marlins were just beginning, even as much as I didn't like them in 1993 with this Bowman set, card number 94. So there you go, the story of Carl Everett, the 93 Bowman set. You can comment on that or anything else that we touched on in today's podcast. We had a lot, not just 93, not just the Florida Marlins, not just Carl Everett, not just my own collecting habits, but also the 2017 sets that have come out. Plenty to discuss. Feel free to chime in at any time on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. It is open 24/7, and we encourage your conversation, just conversation about the hobby on the podcast at any time. All right, we've got another podcast coming your way this Friday, and even though there are some limited choices in my personal 1993 collection, we're going to go back, we're going to take a little bit of a detour here and bring up the studio set from 1993. This was a very, very different set that was created by Leaf. Of course, the Leaf studio set had been out since 91. I didn't have a whole lot of these cards, but the 93 set was so good, I bought quite a few packs back then, and there's some really classy cards, and we'll do a random pull from the 93 Leaf Studio set in our next podcast. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks for joining us on Wax Ecstatic. Tune in on Audio Boom. You can check out our archive at audioboom.com. Just search Wax Ecstatic, or you can have our podcast delivered to you via iTunes every Tuesday and Friday as well. We'll see you next time on Wax Ecstatic.